This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We're talking about a different kind of child separation now, the kind that has to be done because the home would be unsafe for those kids. We've heard a lot about the opioid epidemic. What we don't hear much about is the impact on the children of addicted parents. Claudia Rowe writes about this in the Seattle Times, the impacts of the opioid crisis on our elementary school children. You base this story on cases in the Everett area?
I looked at Everett because Snohomish County is a real hot spot for fallout from the opioid crisis in Washington State, but it is across the state. It is heavily in Spokane. It is King County, Pierce County. It's everywhere.
And these kids are trying to lead normal lives, essentially, while their parents are in crisis. How do you do that?
I think it's pretty impossible. One of the more hidden effects of the opioid crisis is what happens in schools. So that was my original directive from an editor. Go see what the fallout is in schools. And I think people might look at, oh, older kids using drugs, getting high. But really, the larger impact in schools was with little kids, right? These are the children of opioid-addicted and meth-addicted parents who are acting out in ways that educators have never really seen before, they say. And part of that is because of foster care. So many kids have been removed into foster care, which is an extremely traumatic experience for any child, even if the foster care placement is a healthy and good one. Just the separation from a parent has really profound effects on kids, as we've all seen from coverage of the ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, the ACEs phenomenon, has actual physiological effects in people's brains, and it dramatically affects behavior and learning.
How many kids are we talking about in Snohomish or in King County?
In 2017, approximately 525 kids were removed from addicted parents in Snohomish County. In King County, it was 1,005, and there could be more.
So you have the state involved, you have now schools involved. What role does the school play when these children are being bumped from foster home to foster home away from their addicted parents?
We hear often about the way schools have to sort of plug the gaps and act as kind of social service agencies in many instances. This is kind of a whole different level of ratcheting up. They are hearing from parents who come in and kind of unburden themselves on the principal, on the front office staff, saying, I have to go into rehab, or my kids were removed and they're with CPS now, and you might be hearing from a social worker, or I thought I was okay, but I've relapsed. They're using the school staff, because that's their only avenue, as essentially social workers, as therapists and social workers and people to help them find jobs and find housing. These schools are now becoming kind of social service hubs in a way that, of course, they step up to answer as much as they can, but it's a heavy, heavy load. There is a fantastic principal in Everett who is highlighted in my story who just sort of very pluckily says, you know, this is the job now and this is what I do and I'm going to do it. But she was quite upfront and said schools are supposed to be about learning and about academics, and that's not what kids are focused on. They can't. They can't concentrate. They are play acting, like reviving overdosed parents during recess. They are acting it out in the playground. Pretend medics.
That's frightening.
That's what I think we need to hear about, how this plays out in class. Because there is research indicating that even kids who have had non-dysfunctional childhoods, if they're in a class with someone who's had a dysfunctional childhood, it's contagious.
Correct. It affects everyone.
So parents hearing this, I think they want to be sympathetic to the plight of these kids. But I also think they want to make sure their kid is not in class with them. And I'm wondering whether school districts are rethinking the whole mainstreaming idea as a result of this. Because I know teachers who don't think it's helping either child, either the child who needs the more intense help or the children who now are seeing their education put in jeopardy because of what's going on in the classroom.
That's a really good question, and it gets into the entire special education realm, which is an enormous can of worms. I can tell you that the school that I looked at in Everett has various types of self-contained classrooms for kids with behavioral outbursts. Mm-hmm. And I also think there's probably a lot to be said for not kind of quarantining kids and corralling them off by themselves. I haven't heard from anyone who says that is helpful to the kid. So I can't give you a definitive answer on what's the best way to go there. I see educators struggling mightily to try to intervene early with almost no resources. And the self-contained classroom I saw in Everett was, it was not a happy place. I saw teachers working really, really hard with really difficult kids, and I didn't have a chance to ask them, do you think this is the best way to go? I don't know the answer to that question yet. I think that augurs for more reporting.
Yeah. Claudia Rose's piece is on the impact of the opioid crisis on our elementary school children. It's in today's Seattle Times. Claudia, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
CBS mentioned the haggling continues in Congress over a way forward in immigration reform. My question for Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan this morning, what did the White House expect? That Congress would act quickly?
Well, if there are some in the White House who thought that forcing a crisis with forced action, they made the wrong calculation, because we are not seeing that momentum in Congress, and you really weren't seeing the White House put its shoulder behind any of the legislative fixes that had been proposed. What you did see is a forced crisis that has kicked off one of these culture war issues, something that sends people farther into their corners. Whether that ultimately backfires for Republicans coming into those November congressional races, or perhaps helps some of the president's supporters within the party, we'll see. But what we have seen is this rare moment where both sides of the country really kind of came together and said, on this narrow issue, for this short period of time, we can all agree that we do not like to see children and their parents separated. And so you see the short-term fix with the president signing this executive order. It does not solve the problem. It just buys more time.
I read this morning that of all people, Dianne Feinstein, arch liberal, and Ted Cruz, arch conservative, have actually been discussing border solutions. Is that serious?
There have been a number of senators who've tried to step forward. You've also seen Senator Collins of Maine, Senator Flake come forward. You've seen Senator Lindsey Graham, who really months back, if you remember, tried to get some legislation through to fix some of these bigger immigration issues. The challenge has been that the White House and even the Republican majority Congress haven't really been able to work together, because there isn't consensus within the party, and then there isn't the ability to win over that narrow number of Democratic votes that are needed to get any kind of proposal over the threshold here. The president has stuck to this idea that he wants border funding for his border wall included in any large-scale immigration package. And for some Democrats, it is hard to sign on to that agreement on principle. It is also something that, if you believe the hard right supporters of the president, like Steve Bannon, these culture war issues are something that fires up a base. And so the anger in and of itself serves a purpose, even if it doesn't actually add up to any kind.
Margaret, what does this base want? This base, I assume we're talking about the crowd in Duluth that was cheering wildly for the president. What exactly do they think is going to happen here? How does this not come across as being either simply incompetent or, worst case, completely racist?
I can't speak for what those people shouting in the crowds may be, motivated by when they are backing these policies. I can say that the president seems to be making this argument on immigration based purely on security. The problem is that it is hard to match his words that there is a threat overwhelming our border, that you need to see a hardline immigration policy because of a security threat, when the pictures you're seeing are of infants and of children. Those two ideas contradict each other. And I think you saw this theory of we can look tough by taking this hardline immigration stance really contradicted by what the reality of the situation was at the border, that these are people fleeing. And yes, there are bad actors among them. And yes, there are child traffickers among them. But that's not the majority of people coming across the border fleeing violence in El Salvador and Honduras.
I suppose if it did accomplish one positive thing, it did force reporters to tell the individual stories here. And what we find is that, in fact, as you say, most of these are not the bad guys. These are the victims of the bad guys trying to flee the bad guys. Why is nobody going after the bad guys? Whose responsibility? I mean, that would be Mexico's responsibility, right? That would be El Salvador, Guatemala. What are their governments doing? Anything?
Well, what you're seeing right now is El Salvador is the murder capital of the world. You're seeing a government that is in crisis and overwhelmed by gang violence. You're seeing economic and political crisis in Honduras. Mexico is actually one of our better partners on the security front in terms of stopping people before they get to the U.S. border. The people who can be deported quickly are Mexicans. The people who cannot are those from those other countries that we don't have, these deportation agreements with, like Honduras and El Salvador. So if you want to talk about things that the United States can do there, you can talk about investment, you can talk about foreign aid, you can talk about security. But those are bigger conversations to be had. They are not solved just because of this one crisis that has been put in place with the separation of families. This is extremely complicated. It's why the Obama administration failed at solving it. The Bush administration failed at solving it.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. She joins us every Friday on Seattle's Morning News.
Do you remember the first time you saw a dinosaur?
It is movie time on Seattle's Morning News, and here he is, Michael Medved, to take a look at Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. Where does this come in the series?
This is the fifth film overall. It is the second film of a projected three more films that Spielberg authorized, the Jurassic World series, not to be confused with the Jurassic Park series. Now, all of this, it's like the various Spider-Mans or Star Wars movies. I mean, once you enjoy something, I guess, it's good to keep feasting on it. And actually, for people who liked any part of the previous Jurassic Park series, this is a mildly enjoyable film. And it certainly has its impressive aspects. And one of the things that's fascinating to look at is if you go back and look at the first Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. it has these wonderful sort of fresh elements. But the special effects and the creation of the dinosaurs is so crude compared to this, which is dazzling. It's Industrial Light and Magic, the George Lucas originally company, that did the special effects. And you've never seen dinosaurs quite like these.
So what's happening now at Jurassic World?
Okay, what's happening right now is the movie begins with sort of the ultimate jeopardy, which is an exploding volcano on Isla Nublar, which is where they used to set up this, what was a theme park in the immediately previous film that was basically abandoned, destroyed, but the dinosaurs remained in control of Isla Nublar. Now the dinosaurs are threatened by an exploding volcano.
Claire, it's the T-Rex. It's the T-Rex.
Stop! It's not the T-Rex. Probably.
Probably?
Lava! Lava!
Lava! Deep breaths, Rick.
There's a lot of jeopardy. There's a lot of thrills. There are, from the beginning, the very first sequence, you see human beings becoming dinosaur chow. The movie is rated PG-13. But I was thinking about my wife would hate this movie.
Is it pretty? Because I remember in the first, you know, they had the one character who was being tossed around like a, you know, like a ball of yarn, and the T-Rex was a kitten. And I had a hard time watching that when I was younger, but it wasn't graphic.
Okay,
are we getting graphic now?
Well, there's an arm chopped off.
Oh, well.
While a guy is trying to struggle with what's left of him.
Aren't we? Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting, of course, they create a number of new dinosaurs for this movie because there has been a hybrid dinosaur. There was the, what is it, Dominatrix Rex. The name was said, the Dominator Rex or Dominatrix Rex.
Yeah,
Indominus.
I don't think it was Dominatrix Rex. That's a whole other movie.
I know. Right,
well, that's the R-rated version.
50
right.
Shades of T-Rex.
Right. Well, the dinosaurs do have different shades. The good guy dinosaur, Blue, is back, who sort of was raised by Chris Pine. Don't ask.
Chris Pratt,
thank you.
Pine
Pratt, yeah, all the Chris's.
They're all handsome. Blah, blah.
Yeah, and he's good. By the way, did you hear his speech at the MTV Movie Awards?
Yes, he was encouraging young people to pray and that
and
God
to
is
be
taking
good
care
people.
Of them.
And yeah, and it was. And he
you don't
was,
hear that very much in Hollywood.
He was articulate far more articulate than a lot of people in the political sphere right now.
You know, he's a local guy, right? He grew up in Lake Stevens. He still supports the Lake Stevens Boys and Girls Club. I think he's got a place.
He's not married to Anna Faris anymore.
Not married to Anna Faris anymore.
Thank you. I'm glad you're so on.
It's a thing. It's a thing.
Well, of course. But in any event, he's good in the movie.
And Anna Faris is from Edmonds. Sorry.
Yeah, I knew she was local.
Okay.
But I didn't. Edmonds, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
She grew up in Edmonds.
Local.
I know.
Yeah, it's like Hillary Swank, who remembers. Anyway.
Yes.
There's a line in the movie that is repeated at least six times. I'm not kidding because I was counting. And the line is, and you can see it in the script, it's run with three exclamation points. Run! And they're constantly running from exploding lava, from rampaging dinosaurs.
So go for the journey, not the storyline.
Bad guy mercenaries led by Ted Levine.
Well, I wish I'd thought of that line.
Well, this is, again, no Oscars for screenplay, but maybe for special effects. 2.5 stars. It's very well set up for a sequel. And something tells me the sequel will somehow have the... dinosaurs making it to L.A., though I'm not sure how they get there from Britain.
It's always L.A., that or New York.
That's right.
Right.
I'm surprised it's not New York.
You know, Tokyo, of course, is you have the whole Godzilla vibe. But
sure.
Spielberg's name is on this movie. But the one thing about Spielberg movies is they do have generally some heart in addition to dazzle. And this film tries. And again, none of the performances are bad. And I suspect that most people who love the dinosaurs, who love the whole franchise, will find this movie more than adequate.
And so you say the next one is already on the way.
It is.
Well, you know what that means. Run! Thank you, Michael.
Exactly. Thank you, Dave.
Our Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is wearing a cap that says what?
It's a wave.
A wave cap.
Yeah.
Danny O'Neill. Boy, I'm really sorry that I made up that clean sweep call because now I know what it likes to feel swept.
Yeah. You're getting heckled by the people from the Bronx.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got out their push brooms.
They know how to
heckle. How do you like to be swept, Dave Ross?
All right. Stop
what
it.
What do we do with Cornell graduates?
Stop it.
We
stop
sweep
it.
Them up.
I can't take it. Stop it.
This is
so
too bad.
What happened?
What happened was they lost a game they should have won. That was Wednesday. They gave up too many home runs, and they weren't able to catch up to the velocity out of the Yankees' bullpen. There's two big trends in baseball. One is pitchers that throw harder than ever before, and the other is hitters who hit more home runs than ever before. And the Yankees epitomize both. Like, that's what their team is built around. Hard throwers, specifically out of the bullpen, and guys who hit a ton of home runs. And that was the difference yesterday, two home runs in the first inning, and that held up for a 4-3 victory. It was kind of the story of the series. It was a couple two-run homers that decided the game on Wednesday, and they kind of bludgeoned the Mariners. Nobody said it was going to be easy, Dave. Mm-hmm. Nobody said that it was going to be, hey, the worm has turned, and it's all salad days from here on out.
But
it's
going to
be some tough going.
It just feels like that dose of reality, you know, that you now the your eyes are open and you realize, wow, there's a bigger world out there.
They'll turn it around. Let it fuel them.
Or you could look at it like this. A younger team that's contending for the first time,
They
got to toughen up a little bit.
Yeah.
These are the wounds that will create the scar tissue that will allow them to win these kind of games in the future. And that sort of get your jaw set. You can either get busy living or get busy
so
dying.
So they can come back from this is what you're
saying.
That's
exactly right. They're going
to
go to Boston. They're going to go to Boston and they're going to rip those brooms out of the hands of the Bronx Bombers. And they're going to use them to sweep up the Red Sox.
They're going
to
step out of the team bus. They're going to say, we got this time.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Okay, I feel it now.
Who's the cheerleader now?
No, I'm just trying to figure out how I talk to my daughters about this.
Okay, good. No,
it's
I've got
tough.
How many games are left? Lots of games. We got time.
Yeah, we're almost halfway
there
through
the
season.
We're fine.
Yeah, you got six more games till the halfway point. You got seven more games on this road trip.
Explain to me the picture I saw of Ichiro today.
Ichiro was hiding out in the dugout.
Why?
Well, he was wearing a disguise because technically he's not allowed in the dugout.
But everybody knows it.
Yeah.
So is this his humor or?
Yes.
Okay.
Bobby Valentine was a New York Mets manager many years ago, probably about 20 years ago now. He got ejected from a game. Now, when you get ejected, what are you supposed to do?
You're
supposed to leave. He put on a Groucho Marx glasses and came back into the dugout, and it was very funny. Baseball didn't find as much humor in it as the rest of the people did, was because it's kind of a silly thing, right? You get ejected, and like your punishment is like you can't even watch. You got to go in and watch it on TV. I thought it was very funny and coy by Ichiro.
He stayed in the dugout?
I don't know. Ichiro and what Ichiro does in the games remains a gigantic mystery to me, because he's out on the field really quick after the games are over, and he's wearing batting gloves. Like, what's he doing in there?
So
like,
they're not hiding an injury. They're not. This is truly just he's sitting out this season.
He wasn't good enough to be on the team.
Not good enough to
on the team. And he's not ready to retire. I mean, that's you could look at it as a little bit like Milton from The Office. Okay. Or from Office Space, when they're just like, we corrected the code.
Right.
And he just kept coming to work. Like, Ichiro keeps coming to work. The job doesn't really exist. I think it's really cool.
But he is getting paid.
That would probably be a subject of, I don't know how much he's being paid. Is he getting his full salary? And it was a minimum salary. That's probably not a big deal. It wouldn't surprise me if his payroll number is different than what it was when he was a player.
It's just a bizarre limbo, and then you add this mustache disguise to it.
It's great.
Yeah,
it's a mystery of Ichiro.
I like this.
Well, how about him competing in the home run derby? Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's get Ichiro to Washington D.C.
And that just is a matter of what, voting, or some judges have to decide.
I think the baseball's commissioner's office would have to decide. Okay, we're going to do that. I'd love to see it. Huh. Have him wear the mustache.
So the ejection rule is, if you're ejected from a game, you can come back as long as you don't look like you?
No. You have to leave the bench.
Oh.
You can't be in there.
But
which is weird, because you don't have to leave the building, because you can sit there in the bowels of the stadium, and that's fine. The whole thing is funny.
Luckily, they don't have a zero-tolerance policy. You'd be in big trouble. Hey, did any local people get taken in the NBA draft?
Depends. Do you count Michael Porter Jr. as a local?
I don't know who Porter Jr. is.
Oh, Michael Porter Jr. was the number one high school recruit in the country who moved here so his dad could serve on Lorenzo Romar's staff. He went to Nathan Hale. They went undefeated for a year. Then Lorenzo Romar got fired, so then he hightailed it back to Missouri, where he didn't play for most of this season, but then he entered the draft. He's had a very eventful career at the age of 18. He got drafted 14th overall by the Denver Nuggets.
So he moved out here from Missouri to play at Nathan Hale?
For his senior year of high school.
And then moved back when his favorite coach left?
When the coach who recruited him and had hired his father left.
Hmm.
His dad got hired on both staffs, first by Lorenzo Romar and then by Missouri. Seems kind of weird, doesn't it?
I don't know how you... Well,
seems kind of fishy.
Doesn't sound local to me.
No, probably not. And as a matter of fact, I think ringer is the term that we've often used. Nathan Hale won the title that year.
Good player then, right?
Yeah, he's a great player. Although he didn't get drafted as high as we thought, because there were some questions about his medical report. But he went 14th overall to
Denver.
That
kind of thing is not still happening, is it?
What do you mean?
Where you just bring in somebody from another state.
Like, oh, yeah, it happens all the time. Did you not pay attention to Bellevue football? There's a big deal about Bellevue football.
I figure once it's publicized in the paper, they just cut it off.
No.
No,
then the parent booster clubs get together and they argue and talk about unfair journalism and threaten to sue newspapers.
They find a new secret
location
and layer.
So they bring them in, but they put them in a mustache and glasses.
Similar. Yeah, they get an address for them to use. It's the paperwork equivalent of a Groucho Marx disguise.
Some of those kids have beards and mustaches.
And sometimes,
for real.
Sometimes when the coach who was in charge of the team when it was cheating gets caught, he ends up going to another school that's a private school so he can, perhaps some might think, cheat more legally.
I see. All very interesting. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Your Sports Insight is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. You got to have zero tolerance. The question has come up. Why is it that Seattle's interim police chief, Carmen Best, is not even being considered for the post of permanent police chief? And to help us answer that question, Cairo Radio's Mike Lewis joins us. You've been looking into this. Now, this began with the decision to step down by Chief of Seattle Police Department Kathleen O'Toole. Carmen Best has been serving. She's been with the force for how long now?
She's been with the force for... It was interesting when Norm Stamper spoke in Seattle recently. He was the one who actually hired her originally. She's been with the force
26 years.
26 years.
According to your script, anyway. Anyway, so tell me, why is it that she was not even considered? Do we know?
Well, so that I'm actually, again, not here to answer that because I don't actually know. And this is the problem. The Seattle police, the Seattle Community Police Commission, which was set up after a lawsuit and a federal settlement to oversee the police department. It's a citizens advisory commission. It's not they offer advice. They're non-binding, but they are required by law to be in place. They're unhappy because, one, they don't know why Carmen Best wasn't chosen. Mm-hmm. And, two, they feel like the process to get to the three finalists, which we know, was not very transparent. And so they have asked the city council and the mayor's office to suspend the search or suspend the upcoming hearings on the three finalists until they get answers as to why don't we know what this process is? Why don't we know what the assessors are assessing for prior to selecting a police chief?
So who exactly is raising the concerns?
This was set up after a police-involved shooting in 2010. 2013, they set up the Seattle Community Police Commission. Mm-hmm. And the Community Police Commission is a group of people, independent body that oversees police. They will look into if there's a police, an investigation, police shooting, things like that.
But they're not the group that was tasked with picking a new chief.
No, so that's this kind of secret process of assessors. So it's Mayor Durkin, and then she has a group of people. This information we didn't know until Seattle Times managed to get a leaked copy of who actually is on this assessment committee. It includes former county executive Ron Sims, Deputy Mayor Michael Fong, the legal counsel Ian Werner, a couple of other people. These folks created the criteria by which they're going to select a new chief.
That sounds like a pretty diverse group.
No, and it's interesting that they had complained at the beginning of this process, then the commission asked for information, hasn't received it in a month, complained again, and then complained a third time in a letter. And so they're feeling very stonewalled by the mayor's office on the whole process of selecting a chief when they feel like it's their federally mandated duty to oversee these sort of things.
When this first came up, I was just trying to figure out, okay, why would they not consider this person? And isn't it true that typically when an organization, whether it's a government organization or private organization, wants to clean house or change the culture, they are not going to pick an internal candidate because anybody who's been around for 26 years in Carmen Best's case has connections. And when you're trying to change a culture, sometimes you got to fire people. And it's very difficult to fire people you know.
Well, there is an argument to be made for that. I think what the commission is looking for, if there is that argument to be made, and it's a valid argument, make the argument, but make it to the commission. Mm-hmm. And I think that's their issue, is not that you couldn't have criteria by which to not select Carmen Best. I think she's very well regarded.
Yeah.
I've met her. I like her. She's always been smart, straightforward. I think that that's okay. They just feel like there was no transparency in the process, and that is not a good way to select a police chief.
What's the deadline?
So the deadline is, now moving. It's unclear what the city is going to do with this request, but they've got three finalists ready to go. It is Minneapolis Police Department Inspector Cameron McLay, former Pittsburgh Police Chief, Eli Reyes, the Assistant Chief at Austin, and I'm sorry, Eddie Frizzell, who's from Minneapolis. Cameron McLay is from Pittsburgh. And those are the three finalists. They want to do something by the end of summer, certainly, and they'd like to do it sooner than that. But it's unclear whether or not the city is going to respond to this request to delay and provide transparency on the selection process.
Cairo's Mike Lewis. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Choke. Let's go. Points. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. We have warned you about this twice before, and we're hoping you'll listen now that we're warning you the third time. Highway 2 is being closed for a good cause. Chris?
Yeah, and we're hoping that the weather cooperates this time. The construction closure on the westbound Highway 2 trestle has been postponed by rain two times. The forecast looks good, though there is some chance for some convergent zone. And so westbound Highway 2 will be closed between Lake Stevens and Everett at 7 o'clock tonight and remain out of commission through Monday morning. And the forecast has changed a little bit since I talked to Frances Federica when she told me this from the Department of Transportation.
I'm almost afraid to jinx it, but as the forecast stands right now, warm, sunny, perfect combination that we need. No rain. We're going to go this weekend.
Again, we've got a little convergence zone, and we need dry weather for this to go forward. For those of you that don't remember why the state's closing down the trestle, they're repaving it from about Bickford Avenue in the Snohomish side over towards I-5. And this section is asphalt, not concrete, and they're weatherproofing it. That's why this is so weather-dependent.
Other projects, for example, MLK, the Revive I-5, is that we're waterproofing the structure, and that material is the one that's really cannot be exposed to any water at all during the installation process.
So I've been waiting for a text of any kind to hear from Francis whether or not they're going to, you know, have to pull a plug on this thing.
I tried to waterproof a deck once in the rain. It is not a good thing to do.
No, it is not, especially for something that's, you know, carries so much, is such a vital key to that area. So right now it's a go, and we'll keep you close up to date on that. So what does this mean if we go forward with this? It means you're going to have to alter your plans if you're heading to I-5 from Lake Stevens or Snohomish.
What can you do that's different? Can you delay your travel? Can you travel earlier? Can you travel later? Can you carpool? Can you transit? Anything that you can do that's different from the original plans you had as if westbound was open will be immensely helpful during this weekend closure.
Now, the primary alternate will be Highway 9, expected to be slammed in both directions. You can head north into the Marysville exit to access I-5. You can head south through Snohomish and head on down over through Mill Creek or use Lower Larimer to get around. There is a detour on 20th Street Southeast, which is the little road that runs right underneath the trestle. But that road is tiny, and it cannot handle much traffic. I've driven it a couple of times to get ready for this, and believe me, it is small. Now, to access this, you would just head west on Highway 2 like you normally would. You're going to be shuffled over to the left lane, and you're going to get off at the exit there that takes you down under the trestle. And then you would again head west in the eastbound direction of 20th.
We have tons of signage, lots of barrels. It's going to be very thoroughly marked that, yes, this is an uncomfortable feeling heading westbound on an eastbound road, but this is the way that you need to go.
It's really not that hard of a detour. It's you just have to get ready for it, and it's, again, very, very small. This is just the first of six full weekend closures that we're going to have on westbound Highway 2. They're going to run twice a month from now through August, and they've got a little padding time on the backside that they can get this done before school starts again. But, again, we're keeping a very close eye on the weather. They need a 24-hour dry window before they start, and usually they make that call on Thursday night. This is kind of a late arriving possible convergence zone with rain up there, so I'm waiting to hear if they're going to have to make any alternate plans.
I'm impressed that you rehearse. Actually go out and you rehearse the drive?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, if you go to mynorthwest.com, I made a video of it so drivers would be familiar with what they're going to have to do, because it's an unusual move for those of you that are used to doing what you're doing. I like to drive these so I have a pretty good feel for what they are. Then I put it on video so people can see it before they're going to have to do it.
That sets an example. If more of us would just pre-rehearse the upcoming detours, there'd be less confusion.
However, I might have violated the cell phone law while filming that video. but it was for the greater good.
You had your partner with you. You had your cameraman, is what you meant to say.
Well, yeah.
Your cameraman
is kind of a one-man show,
Dave. Really?
It can be kind of except for all my Cairo drivers out there, my Sully's Army, if you want to get in touch with me, I need you. At Cairo Traffic on Twitter, traffic at CairoRadio.com.
I'll have Andrew cut that part out of the podcast.
Trust me, I think the State Patrol already knows seeing how the video kind of shakes a little.